to anything of what you said, but I'll do my best to at least shock you a little bit by saying that perhaps autism isn't all there is, and perhaps autism isn't as severe as we would want it to be. Of course, I consider autism to be a very relevant problem, but I think there is now good evidence that we need to refocus our energy from just thinking about autism to thinking about all the neurodevelopmental disorders that come with it. This is a slide showing the Gillberg Neuropsychiatry Center in Gothenburg, I would just like to alert you to the webmail address, www.gnc.gu.se, if you want to know more about what we do in terms of research and other things at our center. Please go to that site and you'll get a lot more information, much more than what I can bring you this morning. So the theme to this morning, how severe is autism really? I would like to quote Lorna Wing as saying, "Nature never draws a line without smudging it." And when people think about autism as a discrete thing, this is what you need to start thinking about again. Nature never draws a line without smudging it. So it's very unlikely you're ever going to get a case of 100% pure autism. We've done a big study in the Bergen, in the city of Bergen in Norway, where we studied about 9,700 plus children aged 7 to 9 years with data from the Bergen Child Study showing here on the autism spectrum screening questionnaire. And as you can see, there is a decreasing trend from several thousand children actually having no symptom of autism and then at least a few thousand children having one symptom of autism and 1,000 children having 2 symptoms of autism, etc., etc. And this stretches up to 42 symptoms of autism in a few children, and the possible number of symptoms is 54. So you can see that there is no sharp division line here for anything that could be construed as clear. This is a demarcation line where things become pathological. So this is a sort of normal distribution curve. And you can see also that girls have fewer problems in the autism domain than boys. This questionnaire, the autism spectrum screening questionnaire, is much the most widely used internationally in terms of looking for autism symptoms in school-age children. In Japan, for instance, several hundred thousand children have been screened using this instrument. But this is from the same study in Bergen. The previous slide was teacher reports. This is the same instrument used with parents. And as you can see again, there is this trend towards a few thousand children having zero symptoms and then a falling off trend. But there is no sharp demarcation line between those who could be considered to be in the normal range and those who would be considered like autistic disorder or anything like that. And again, you see the same trend that girls are less affected than boys, but not as clearly as in the slide showing the results for teachers. Now, we have also used another instrument, which is also well validated for huge populations, and that's the Autism, Tics, ADHD and Comorbidities scale that we have used in the largest twin study in the world, the Swedish twin study. And here are results from the first 19,131 twins, where you can again see that on a similar scale, the ATAC scale, which stretches from 0 through 0.5 up to 12 points. And if you get above 8.5, you're a possible case. But anyway, the distribution is similar as on the ASSQ, normal type scale, where there is no sharp demarcation line between those who could be considered being in the normal range and those who are clear cases of autism. I should say also that in the Bergen Child Study, even though many percent of the general population have very high ASSQ scores, if you construe a possible autism suspected score as about 10, 8% of the population on the teacher scale would be in the autism range. If you use 15, which is very often used in studies, 3% would have autism, but only about 0.6% of that population was actually diagnosed with autism. So one in five children of those scoring above the level of clear autism according to the scale, only one in five actually got a diagnosis of autism. So there was a time in 1943 and onwards, and Mike Rutter in particular, thought this was a discrete disorder. Autism is the best, he said, and most clearly delineated disorder in child psychiatry, and it's also the most severe. We found in a study published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry in 1983 that autistic traits are very, very common in ADHD and in the general population, and particularly common in the group with ADHD with developmental coordination disorder. And we found autism spectrum disorder 30 years ago exactly to be 0.7% of seven-year-olds. When people talk about an epidemic of autism, we showed already 30 years ago rates of autism in the general population that are exactly at the same level as people are reporting today. Lorna Wing and I have proposed for many, many years that autism is on a continuum. And Mary Coleman and I have proposed that there are several different varieties of autism, and we now refer to autisms rather than autism. And we're not dealing with one spectrum. We're dealing with hundreds of different spectra. We're dealing with the 22q11 deletion spectrum. We're dealing with the 22q13 spectrum. We're dealing with a tuberous sclerosis spectrum, a Fragile X spectrum, a 16p spectrum, etc., etc., etc. And so it's not appropriate to just be thinking about autism as one spectrum, even though when you collate the data, as in a general population study, of course you will get symptoms that seem to appear on a spectrum, but the underlying problems are not one spectrum. 25 almost years ago, I proposed that autism was on a spectrum with normally distributed empathy skills, and that some variants, even of the disorder, could be considered mild, others as moderate, and yet others severe. This, of course, led to some very marked scorn, particularly from Mike Rutter. Now, what about these people? Hans Christian Andersen, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Alain Robbe-Grillet, Immanuel Kant, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Albert Einstein, Béla Bartók, Eric Satie, Anton Bruckner, Vasily Kandinsky, Paul Klee, Edward Hopper, or Stanley Kubrick. Do they have anything in common? Well, who knows? I don't. But at least many people have suggested that these people have something in common. They have very marked autistic features, or at least they had when they were alive. So all these lonely people, because they were certainly lonely, these people, where do they all come from? Do they have autism? Are they severely disabled? Well, to some extent, I would say that somebody like Ludwig Wittgenstein, in many ways, had very severe problems in his life, but he ended his life saying, "Tell everybody I had a fantastic life." So I'm going to propose now that we shouldn't be dealing just with autism. Whenever we study autism, we need to think about, is autism all there is, and is it really the most severe of the problems that we are usually studying when we say we study autism? I've launched the term ESSENCE, Early Symptomatic Syndromes Eliciting Clinical Neurodevelopmental Examinations, because I felt there is a need for people to understand that these things, when they are perceived as disorder, come together. They are clearly these early symptomatic syndromes, beginning and being symptomatic before the age of about 5 years, They are predictors of academic failure, of substance use, of psychiatric disorder, of empathy problems, and of antisocial lifestyles later in life. And in order of prevalence, as they are currently perceived and studied in the general population, ADHD would be the most common of these early symptomatic syndromes eliciting neurodevelopmental clinical examinations. Language disorder would be the next most common. Developmental coordination disorder, about the same prevalence as language disorder. Intellectual disability, about 2% of the general population. And only in fifth place would we find autism spectrum disorder at a rate of currently reported to be about 1.2% of the general population. Tic disorders, specifically Tourette syndrome with OCD, 1%. The behavioral phenotype syndromes that I refer to, things like 22q13.11 deletion, etc., they are almost all of them in the range of 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 20,000 children. But together, they constitute a very large proportion of the general population of children showing early symptoms. So more than 1% of the general population of children actually has one of these syndromes at the current time, and there will be more as we understand more about what causes each individual syndrome. There are a number of epilepsy syndromes that are of great interest in this respect, particularly Landau-Kleffner syndrome, continuous spike wave activity during slow sleep, and febrile seizures plus, and we're currently doing a study on febrile seizures, showing that febrile seizures in themselves are important from this point of view. Rather than saying that febrile seizures are of no consequence, they are a signal very often of an underlying early symptomatic syndrome eliciting neurodevelopmental clinical examinations. Reactive attachment disorder has long been felt to be something that's nothing to do with the brain, even though all the studies that have actually been done shows that it's always something to do with the brain. And certainly, if you look at comorbidity in reactive attachment disorder, as we've done in Glasgow, you will find that they have pragmatic language problems, they have autistic features, they have ADHD, they have developmental coordination disorder, and they have intellectual disability at about the same range as these other disorders, if you're starting to look at comorbidity. We are not sure yet whether to include the pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome of PANS in this group of disorder, but there certainly is a group of children who, about the age of 5 and a bit later, very acutely develop the syndromes that we associate with diagnoses such as ADHD, language disorder, etc. So what is autism? Well, I would say that currently people would agree with me on this slide. The autisms are a group of multifactorially determined conditions that always coexist with other developmental neurological problems in cases where there is impairment. And those problems are specific language impairment, developmental coordination disorder, ADHD, intellectual developmental disorder, tics, OCD, epilepsy, and other medical disorders. And there are almost as many causes as there are cases. Cases with no comorbidity at all are not recognized or impairing early in life, or may be acknowledged perhaps as loners, nerds, weirdos, or geniuses. Synapse and clock genes play a major role in cases with impairment, but environmental factors such as prematurity, fetal drug and toxin exposure, infections, trauma, and vitamin D deficiency all contribute to or are associated with the clinical presentation in many cases and can themselves cause autism in some instances. We know that there are abnormalities or variations of the default network, and decreased connectivity is an almost universal finding in studies that have looked into it. Impaired social facial perception is there in a large subgroup, and this is related to specific brain areas. There are arousal and sleep problems that are important in big subgroups in the autism field. There is no sharp boundary between autism and autistic traits, or between autistic traits and normality. You do not grow out of autism, whether it's impairing or not, but impairment may increase or decrease and is usually an effect of comorbidities rather than of autism per se. What is ADHD? ADHD is largely genetic and almost always coexisting with other problems, oppositional defiant disorder, developmental coordination disorder, intellectual disability, tics, OCD, ASD, anxiety, epilepsy, in cases with clinical impairment. So the story is very similar. If you get a case that comes to see you in a clinic, you don't get ADHD per se. You get ADHD plus. Just as with autism, if a case of autism presents at a clinic before the age of 5, it's never, ever pure. Never, ever. There isn't any one case which is completely pure that comes to a clinic before the age of 5. They always have something else, and the same holds for ADHD. We know that similar symptoms of ADHD result not just after genetic insults or genetic variation, but also after various types of environmentally caused brain dysfunction, with or without a genetic predispositions. Again, in prematurity, in fetal drug and toxin exposure, infections, there isn't as much. I mean, there's only a little evidence when it comes to vitamin D and autism, but it's strongly growing and fast. In ADHD, the evidence is very much less obvious, but again, there are new studies coming out in this field as well. There's atypical brain development in children with ADHD. We know that there's growing evidence that dopamine-dependent reward systems in the brain are deviant in ADHD. And we again know that the default network and connectivity problems are very prevalent. Executive function is poor, but this may not be caught on the specific executive function tests. As in autism, arousal and sleep problems are very important in a large subgroup. Failure to perceive errors appear to be typical of many. ADHD and autism are related in some families. Bipolar disorder and ADHD are related in other families. Tourette's syndrome and ADHD are related in some yet other families. Again, as with autism, there's no sharp boundary between ADHD and normality. And if we're talking about autism spectrum disorder, which, as I said, I'm not quite happy with, we should be talking about ADHD as a spectrum disorder as well. You do not grow out of ADHD either. If you meet criteria for ADHD under the age of 5, you'll never get rid of it completely. You'll have some symptoms for the probably rest of your life. But, as with autism, impairment may increase or decrease over time, depending on a number of different things. So, if we accept that these things usually come together, and that children with one of these disorders will present variably at a language therapist, or a child psychiatrist, or a child neurologist, or a pediatrician, or a clinical geneticist's office, or at a psychologist's office, and we see them as very often comorbid one with each other and overlapping over the years as well, what would be the first symptoms of these disorders? Well, if you look at children who come to clinics before the age of 5 presenting with any kind of developmental problem, what is it that parents and others complain about? It's slow general development, abnormal motor coordination or perceptual development, communication and language problems, activity and impulsivity problems, attentional problems, not listening, not seemingly to hear and have normal hearing. But once you test the child, you'll find, well, there isn't anything specifically wrong with hearing, but there still is a problem around the child's listening. And that usually means the child doesn't concentrate. And children who are worked up for a hearing problem under the age of 5 who do not have a hearing impairment should definitely all be looked at from the point of view, don't they have ADHD, don't they have ASD, don't they have one of the other disorders? Social interaction and reciprocity is increasingly something that parents come to clinics to ask about, and actually asking, does my child have autism? Behavior, including insistence on sameness, can be the first presenting symptom. Even in one-year-olds, extreme insistence on sameness is typical of quite a large proportion of the clinically impaired group with autism. Tics and OCD can sometimes be the presenting symptom, although tics usually don't appear as a clinically impairing problem until after the age of about 5. Mood swings and emotional dysregulation are more and more presenting problems in the group who are now diagnosed with ADHD under the age of 5. and sleep and feeding problems lasting for more than 6 months should certainly be seen as markers for this type of problem. What are the early symptoms of autism? Well, we know from retrospective studies and prospective video studies that motor control problems in the first year of life are probably the first signs that this could be autism. Perceptual problems are very common, behavior problems as well, repetitive movements, language problems, no or little reaction to own name, although this seems to be more typical of kids in the United States than in Sweden. We couldn't replicate the finding in our most recent study where we looked at 2.5-year-olds with autism. They weren't typified by no reaction to name, but maybe that's to do with US people very often saying the name of the child all the time, as US people tend to do with everyone. They keep mentioning the person they're talking to, like every 3 words. And so this could be different in this part of the world. We found, though, and many others have found that too, that initiation of joint attention could perhaps be quite significant and a strong marker for autism specifically. Hyperactivity and impulsivity are very common problems in very young children with autism, and usually much more marked than in the sort of garden variety case of so-called ADHD. Hypoactivity can be the presenting problem, sleep problems, food fads and other feeding problems, and delay general development in a smaller subgroup, major mood swings in 10%, and one or several of the above could be the presenting complaint. We've also looked at the ALSPAC study, and the results from there support this group of early symptoms in autism. Now, in ADHD, you'll see that exactly the same problems, except the failure to initiate joint attention, which hasn't been shown to be specifically associated with ADHD in any study so far. But on the other hand, usually people haven't looked at it, so we don't know that it's not also quite typical of children who later get a diagnosis of ADHD. The point here is that you can't differentiate between children with autism and ADHD at a very early age just by looking at what are the presenting symptoms. Not at this point in time. How many people are actually affected by these early symptomatic syndromes? More than 10% under 18 years have or have been affected in the past by so-called neuropsychiatric or neurodevelopmental disorders, including ADHD, autism, Tourette syndrome, conduct disorder, developmental coordination disorder, and intellectual disability. Half this group was discovered by age 6, and more than half of the group will have persistent problems in adult life. Overlap, comorbidity, coexistence is the rule. There is almost never one problem only. This applies across the whole board, not just to autism and ADHD. I've just singled those two out to make the point. But if you have Tourette syndrome as a clinically impairing phenomenon, and the child actually comes to you as a patient, that child always has either ADHD, OCD, depression, anxiety, or something more than just the tic disorder. Otherwise, he wouldn't be a patient. So that's the point of my talk. The patients that we see become patients because they have comorbidity. They don't come to you if they have one of these problems. When looking back, the vast majority of children who later get one of these or several of these diagnoses had symptoms before 5 years of age. Still, girls are not, as we heard, recognized until adolescence or adult age, and they're usually recognized as non-essence. They're not recognized as having ADHD or autism or tic disorders. They're recognized as having depression, anxiety, and family relationship problems. We have done population estimates on the basis of published register data in Sweden showing that more than half of all chronic adult psychiatric patients have had one of these disorders: autism, ADHD, Tourette syndrome, intellectual disability, language disorder. So adult psychiatry also needs to take this into account. It's not just for developmental people, not just for child people. If at least 10% of the population are affected, this is clearly a public health problem. And for some of the subgroups, we actually think we know what to do, such as in ADHD in particular, to some extent for autism, for intellectual disability, and quite a lot is known about specific language impairment. And for a few of the subgroups, we actually have very good evidence that we not only do we think we know what to do, but what we know works. What we do actually works. For some of these subgroups, there are very good screening instruments that we know work in real life with high positive predictive value and sensitivity. That's true for autism. That's true for specific language impairment. So really, for some of these, should we not screen? Well, in the United States, people do screen for these things, at least in pediatric clinics, etc. But in this part of the world, people are so afraid of screening anything that they don't. And I think at least anybody who attends any kind of clinic where children show up for whatever should screen for these problems. What predicts what in autism? If we follow children up from a very young age, as we've done, from the age of about 2.5 to about the age of 40 years of age in several different sets of studies, all of them population-based, we find that the outcome of autism is predicted by the presence of early language delay, early language disorder diagnosed, and low IQ. That's what predicts outcome in autism more than anything else. And this has been known for a long, long time. Mike Rutter said it many, many years ago. Medical disorders, including epilepsy, predict poor outcome. And several groups have shown this, although this has not been taken seriously by some. ADHD in autism predicts poor outcome. More and more studies indicate that the presence of inattention, hyperactivity, and a poor executive function in ASD predicts poor outcome in ASD. Nonverbal learning disabilities. Several new studies from our group and others suggest that nonverbal learning disability predicts poor outcome in autism. Intervention, as we've shown in a number of different studies, may or may not predict outcome. And I think the jury is still out, whatever people say. If you do large-scale naturalistic studies, you won't find the dramatic effects of early intervention, specifically for autism, that people currently talk about as being so overall important. In all the studies that have looked in detail at this, autism load in itself does not predict outcome. So you could have very high scores on the ASSQ or on the SCQ or on the ADOS or whatever, and it doesn't tell you very much about your future life. What tells you very much about your future life is what you have in terms of IQ, what you have in terms of language disorder, epilepsy, medical disorder, ADHD, nonverbal learning disability. Two-thirds, for instance, of males with Asperger syndrome in our very long-term follow-up studies have medium to good outcomes. They had terrible problems when they were young because they had additional problems, and it's the group with the most additional problems outside of the Asperger's diagnosis that have the poor outcomes. The ones who had less of comorbidity had very good outcomes. So if we screen for these disorders, what will happen? Is there a cure? Well, not really, except in rare circumstances. We're looking for cures. We're looking for hopeful new treatments. But for most of them, at the current stage, we don't have any cures. But even with no cure, there is much help to be had in virtually all cases. Psychoeducation, parent expertise, adaptive skills training, ESSENCE or autism or ADHD-friendly environments, individualized programs, remedial education, and sometimes medication can be very helpful. Particularly, we know that medication can be extremely helpful for ADHD and actually change the life course of some people with ADHD in a very, very positive way, as has been shown, for instance, in the Swedish twin study. So how should we proceed if we suspect autism, ADHD, or any of the other ESSENCE disorders at a very early age? We should try, if possible, to observe the child outside the clinic. We have done a number of new studies on very young children with autism showing that the best way to obtain the most information as quickly as possible is observing the child in the preschool. Nothing beats that. But very often we don't have the opportunity of doing that, so we should also, of course, observe the child carefully, even if the child comes only to the clinic, for things like joint attention, attention and listening, behavior, communication, activity, impulsivity, emotional regulation. There are a number of good questionnaires that have been validated, not just US questionnaires, but actually European and Scandinavian questionnaires, which have very large databases to support them. Things like 5 to 15, 2 to 5, the ATAC, as I mentioned, the SDQ, the SNAP, which is actually a US instrument, and the ASSQ. A parent interview by doctors and psychologists need to be done, a medical and neurologic and psychiatric examination, a detailed one of the child needs to be done in all cases, hearing, vision, height, weight, head circumference, genetic discussion, screening for thyroid and metabolic disorders, and EEG sometimes, much more often than currently, and particularly sleep EEG. Assessment of intellectual functioning and neuropsychological strengths and weaknesses should be performed immediately and not be postponed year after year after year. We've seen in the most recent large-scale study in Sweden how the matter of IQ and intellectual functioning has been pushed to the side and the diagnosis of autism has overshadowed everything, and parents haven't been advised about the fact that the child also has actually moderate or severe learning disability, which probably is much more important than the specific and only diagnosis of autism. So how should we plan for the best intervention? We need to recognize all the problems of the children presenting to us at a young age, not just the autism, the ADHD, the developmental coordination disorder, the Tourette syndrome, and all interventions must be individually tailored to meet the needs of the child. And it isn't sufficient to say this is autism. It isn't sufficient to say this is DCD. All the children that come to see us before the age of 5 or even 7 have more than this one diagnosis. Parent training and education plan is perhaps still the most important of all, understanding the condition, but parent essence problems also needs to be taken into account. Many parents of children with one of these diagnoses have something of a similar type. Some people call it shadow syndrome, etc., but sometimes the parent actually has just as many problems as the child and in many different areas, and that needs to be taken into account in treatment planning. ADHD per se, or when combined with ASD, tic disorders, epilepsy, is usually responsive to treatment, medications, computer training, possibly even small effects of omega-3. More and more studies show that there are small but clear positive effects of omega-3 supplementation in ADHD. DCD, developmental coordination, the most underrated of all the disorders in this group, and one which should and must come to the attention of clinicians now. We've been asking for this to be put at the focus of what people diagnose and do something about for more than 30 years. I think it's high time people take it on board that DCD is an important problem in itself and should be addressed. Epilepsy, when present, should always be treated as a top priority, which it isn't, and people still miss continuous spike wave activity during slow sleep again and again and again. Sleep disorders are sometimes responsive to melatonin or dose adjustment of other medications. Violent behaviors and self-injury can be responsive to low-dose neuroleptics or mood stabilizers. You shouldn't treat tics unless they are extremely severe. Do not treat autism per se with medications. Psychoeducation, communication enhancement, essence-friendly environments, and behavioral approaches are first and foremost the things that we need to focus on as long as we don't have more rational treatments. But rational treatments are emerging in subgroups with diagnosis of autism, ADHD, and other essence problems, including in tuberous sclerosis and Fragile X syndrome. Now, I'm going to spend the rest of the talk talking a little bit about how autism overlaps with all sorts of other things and how it differs in boys and girls. We looked at a study of 100 girls who were referred to our clinic for either peer problems, social interaction problems, or attention difficulties. Only two of those 100 3- to 18-year-old girls had ever been given a diagnosis of an essence condition like autism or ADHD. Two of them had been given a diagnosis of autism, and the other 98 never had a diagnosis of any of these disorders been discussed. 47 of the girls actually met criteria for autism, and most of them also met criteria for ADHD. If they met criteria for autism, 80% met criteria for ADHD as well. 47 other girls had ADHD only, meaning that they didn't have autism, but they certainly had things like developmental coordination disorder, language disorder, and other problems. All of the girls, virtually all of them, had been diagnosed as having depression, anxiety, or family relationship problems, and some had been diagnosed already before the age of 18 with personality disorder. We actually believe that autism and ADHD were more important diagnoses in this group than the other diagnoses they had been given. Particularly, diagnoses of anxiety disorder and family relationship problems are usually not helpful for young girls with autism or ADHD or the combination of the two. In anorexia, bulimia and obesity, autism, ADHD and tics are quite common. And Elizabeth Vence, for instance, has shown that in a specialist clinic of eating disorder women, more than half had one or more of autism, ADHD or Tourette syndrome. This is adult eating disorder clinics. 0% had been considered from that point of view in the eating disorder clinic. ADHD, we now know, is extremely common in obesity in children, and ADHD treatment helps both conditions, and you can actually avoid surgery in a number of cases. If you diagnose ADHD in obesity and you treat the ADHD within that group of problems. We've shown in a number of different studies that autism and ADHD are quite common in schizophrenia and in personality disorder. Many with a diagnosis of schizophrenia have a developmental and symptom history consistent with ASD. This has been shown by other groups for a long, long time. But again, it's sort of just been taken off the radar because, of course, autism and schizophrenia have nothing to do with each other. That's common wisdom. But that isn't common wisdom, or shouldn't be. Large proportion of men with Asperger's syndrome, of course, meet criteria for personality disorder. The vast majority meet criteria for obsessive-compulsive personality disorder or schizoid personality disorder, or even some of them for narcissistic personality disorder and some for paranoid personality disorder. And it's very likely that adult psychiatric patients with ASD will get diagnosis of schizophrenia and personality disorder rather than autism with or without ADHD. So, what are the conclusions at this stage? ASD, autism spectrum disorder, even though it's not a spectrum disorder, but it's going to be called autism spectrum disorder under the DSM-5, and it's a pity because it's going to last for probably 10, 15, 20 years, and it isn't one spectrum disorder. And ADHD are but two of a group of early symptomatic syndromes eliciting neurodevelopmental clinical examinations. They overlap genetically, they overlap from the point of view of symptoms, early symptoms, later symptoms, and comorbidity across life, and as regards brain dysfunction and brain variation. They are clearly genetically based in many cases, but environmental factors play an important role, and we still have to get a handle on how important those other epigenetic or other factors are in the case of autism and ADHD. Both disorders persist into adult life, as do most adolescents. ADHD is common, and actually autism is also relatively common, and this isn't an epidemic that just came the last few years. 30 years ago, remember, it was as common as it is today, at least in Sweden. Other psychiatric disorders emerge over time or become so-called diagnosable over time. And these, of course, depression, anxiety, personality disorder, schizophrenia, psychosis, etc., drug abuse, are the diagnoses that adult psychiatrists will make. Autism in itself, this is what I'm trying to get across, has a different outcome. There can be no doubting the fact that autism, if you have autism at a young age, if you have marked autistic features at a young age, you will retain many of those features for years and years and perhaps for the rest of your life. You're not going to be like everybody else. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have a very, very, very poor outcome, as witnessed perhaps by the slide showing some of the famous people who possibly had at least very marked autistic features. I believe that the current focus on autism only in screening, research and intervention programs is a big, and I mean really big, mistake. I think people will have to get away from dealing with autism as an isolated phenomenon only. It's always, when it's clinically impairing, it's always associated with other problems. And if we don't look at those other problems, how can we ever tease out what's typical of autism? And when people say, well, we have this pure case and this population with autism with nothing else, I no longer believe they're actually telling the truth. Because if you look carefully at all children showing up early in life with autism, they all of them have something other than just autism. We know that intellectual disability has a poor outcome, whatever that means, but at least it usually doesn't lead to an independent adult life. Specific language impairment, much the same. Many children with specific language impairment have poor outcomes. ADHD probably has a worse outcome than autism in itself, if we could make it pure, but we can't, at least not on the basis of the studies that have been performed to date. We know that girls are missed or misdiagnosed, and this is a huge problem, and it continues to be a huge problem. And even when people say, well, we now look at girls, they still don't do it carefully enough. And we need to understand much better what the phenotype of autism in girls is. For instance, we've just completed a study of very young boys and girls under the age of 3 with a clinical diagnosis. They were screened in the general population for autism, and they came to the clinic because they were screened positive for autism. And the girls who actually show up and get a clinical diagnosis of autism before the age of 3 have exactly the same phenotype as the boys. But we know from other studies of older cases that many of the girls must have been missed, because they don't look exactly the same if you look at girls at, say, the age of 15. We do know that early diagnosis makes a difference. I think there can be no doubting the fact that early diagnosis makes, and usually a positive difference, both to parents and children. But we don't know exactly what we should be doing, even though some people think they know exactly what should be done. I'm not going to go through these. If anybody wants the slides, it's possible to get them through the GNC website. So these are the final conclusions that I would like to end on. Essence is not a diagnosis. I haven't introduced this concept with a view to getting another diagnosis in the diagnostic manuals. It's a new word for an old phenomenon. ADHD, autism, Tourette syndrome, they overlap to a very marked degree throughout life and are often not clearly separable. That doesn't mean to say we should not try to separate them out one from another. I think it's essential that we continue to try and do that. But we need to understand that if one comes up at a very young age, it's going to be accompanied by at least one more, probably several more, of the problem types. All children presenting with major and impairing essence symptoms need to be followed up. And I think we need to start thinking about essence clinics or child development clinics much more than we currently do. And don't just look at autism. Even though refined diagnosis is needed in all cases, at early stages, essence may be the only safe label, but it's not a diagnosis. Don't tell parents he will grow out of it. He won't. It's very unlikely. It's going to be a problem for several years. If there is a problem in any of these domains very early on, it's going to be a problem for several years if we don't do anything about it. Essence is an extreme risk factor, not autism per se, for adolescent-adult social exclusion, academic failure, antisocial personality disorder, and for non-handicapping autistic features throughout life. We still know very little about early intervention. The over-focus on autism in young children is probably a big mistake, as I've said several times. For some of the essence, including ADHD and some of the behavioral phenotype syndromes, we can screen and intervene early. All advanced societies, therefore, need to increase and spread knowledge about essence, including ADHD and intellectual disability, and not just about autism. Thank you. Thank you.